It is nearly 12 o'clock and time for the KNXT Midday Report. Thank you for listening to KNXT, broadcasting on 100.1 FM. It is your public radio station from beautiful downtown Kodiak, Alaska, where it is 46 degrees, fair and windy. In fact, they have northwest winds steady at 30 miles per hour, gusting to 49 miles per hour at the airport, where they still have 10 miles of visibility as well. The weather service is calling for sunny skies today, mostly sunny tomorrow, mostly cloudy on Friday, back to mostly sunny Saturday, Sunday, and Monday. Coming up on the Midday Report, the Kodiak Aleutic Museum has a new Atkuk. We'll find out what that is. Fuel barges are late in the Yukon-Kuskokwim Delta, and they're beginning to worry. And are miners in British Columbia violating human rights in Southeast Alaska? Those stories and more after national headlines.
Live from NPR News, I'm Lakshmi Singh. More than 2 million people in the Gaza Strip are under complete siege by the Israeli military as it continues to bombard the Palestinian territory following a deadly attack on Israel by Hamas militants earlier this month. NPR's Aya Batraoui reports Egypt's president warns the volatility could spread to other parts of the region.
Egypt's president Abdel Fattah al-Sisi says what's happening in Gaza is not only a military operation against Hamas militants who carried out the attacks in Israel. He warns there's also a, quote, idea to displace Palestinians from their homes and into Egyptian territory, adding that could also lead to Palestinians in the West Bank being pushed into Jordan. And if that happens, al-Sisi said, the creation of a Palestinian state wouldn't be possible because there would be land but no people. Egypt's president also said if Palestinians in Gaza are pushed into Egypt's Sinai Peninsula, their ideologies of resistance against Israel would simply continue from there, adding the situation could quickly spiral and pull Egypt and Israel into conflict. He was speaking at a press conference in Cairo with German Chancellor Olaf Scholz. Aya Batraoui, NPR News, Jerusalem.
President Biden's returning from a seven-hour-plus visit to Tel Aviv, Israel. He expressed solidarity with the ally while also urging Israel to continue pursuing peace.
As hard as it is, we must keep pursuing peace. We must keep pursuing a path so that Israel and the Palestinian people can both live safely, in security, in dignity, and in peace. For me, that means a two-state solution.
He also condemned yesterday's explosion at a Gaza hospital that killed hundreds of Palestinian civilians. He sided with Israel's claim that, based on current evidence, it was a result of a, quote, errant rocket fire by a terrorist group in Gaza, end quote. But protesters across the Arab world are blaming Israel for the heavy loss of life in Gaza. Cities in multiple countries held demonstrations. While on Capitol Hill, a number of protesters against the Israel-Hamas war gathered in the rotunda of the Cannon House office building in Washington, D.C. today. On the Hill, there will be no more votes today in the House for Speaker. House Republicans voted once again to reject Representative Jim Jordan. This was on the second round of voting. NPR's Claudia Grisales has the latest.
Judiciary Chairman Jim Jordan came up short for a second time in as many days as opposition to his nomination grew from 20 to 22. Jordan could only afford to lose a handful of Republican votes in the tightly controlled chamber. Soon after the vote, Jordan went into a closed-door meeting with former House Speaker Kevin McCarthy. It remains unclear what next steps House Republicans can take after failing to elect a speaker yet again.
That's NPR's Claudia Grisales reporting. U.S. stocks end the day lower, with the Dow Jones Industrial Average closing down 332 points. This is NPR News.
Ang NPR Balita ay hatid sa inyo ng Providence Kodiak Island Counseling Center. Para sa kaukulang impormasyon tungkol sa aming mga serbisyo, tumawag lamang sa 481-2400.
For KNXT, I'm Terry Haynes. Kodiak's Aleutic Museum recently acquired a newly minted atkuk, a kind of traditional clothing. As KMXT's Brian Venois reports, staff says it fills a gap in their collections and they're excited to share it with the public.
An atkuk is a type of traditional Aleutic clothing. This one kind of looks like a black floor-length dress with red stripes and white fur. Amanda Lancaster is a curator of collections at the Aleutic Museum.
Snowballing parka is what these are sometimes known as, and when someone is dancing wearing it, you see, you know, the ermentals just sort of sway, and it really does look like, you know, snow falling.
The atkuk was commissioned by the museum about a year ago, and staff received the new piece just a few weeks ago. Lancaster said it was made very similar to ones that had been worn since before Western settlers came to Kodiak. She says once they had the funding, they talked to a local artist to help them fill the gap in their collections.
We have never had a traditional atkuk like this. There are garments like this in collections around the world that hold Aleutic collections.
The commission was funded through a grant from the Rasmussen Foundation, which awards grants to Alaska-based nonprofits and tribes. Lancaster says commissioning pieces helps the museum have one of the most complete collections on Aleutic culture in the world.
It's a really good chance to see, like, what are the holes in our collection that maybe there are Aleutic cultural materials in other museums that we do not have that we would, you know, like to get versions of.
Lancaster says adding to their collections will be a major help in continuing revival movements after historic suppression. The Aleutic Museum is currently undergoing major renovations, though, so the public will have to wait to see the atkuk in person until they reopen in 2025. The multi-million-dollar project will include a classroom for educational opportunities and expand their gallery to feature more of their collections on Native history. In Kodiak, I'm Brian Venois.
Villages in the Yukon-Kuskokwim Delta say some fuel barges have been late this season. The region needs to get its winter fuel in before the river freezes up. Now the water is low and the river is more treacherous. As KYUK's Sunny Bean reports, Vitus Energy does expect to wrap up its fall fuel deliveries this week.
The last of the villages in the YK Delta are waiting on their fall fuel deliveries. In the Puskiak, Teddy Sipri, who distributes fuel, expected it by last Friday at the latest. Now, it's expected Wednesday. Akiak and Akiachuk also received theirs this week. John Wagner, president and CEO of North Star Gas, which partners with Vitus Energy, said, "The last of the villages, New Nupachuk, will probably receive their fuel by Friday, the 20th, or this weekend." He said New Nupachuk is last because they filled out their paperwork late. Those final fuel deliveries will depend on the conditions of the river.
Tides are an issue pretty much in a lot of the villages. That's why they kind of have to wait certain days to get in there, depending on what the water level is. And if it's a good tide, usually they go on there at a high tide to unload. And then they're there a day, tide goes out, comes back in, and they can go out in the river safely.
Wagner said there can be a lot of reasons for delays. It can be because of high winds and erosion at delivery spots. There has also been an increased number of inspections by the Coast Guard, which takes time. Sometimes the barges get stuck on a sandbar or have mechanical issues. Sometimes they can't get in touch with the person of contact, or they don't have the right signatures or paperwork to go ahead.
A good example, Quinnahawk, their particular area where we used to deliver fuel was so shallow, we couldn't even get in there. So we had to run, 1,800 feet of hose to get fuel to their tank farm because the barge couldn't get in because there's so much erosion. And the river, it goes down and it deposits right where they were delivering fuel before. You can't get in there. It's too shallow now.
While the villages order and prepay for the fuel, sometimes months in advance, that doesn't guarantee a timely delivery. Tuluksak spent the summer waiting for their spring fuel delivery from Vitus. It was expected early last June, but their fuel inventory wasn't delivered till months later, in the last week of September. Tuluksak Tribal Administrator Angela Alexi said,
"That was way so much slower than they usually deliver the spring and fall."
Last year, the fuel wasn't usually late, too. Over the summer, Vitus made a few small fuel deliveries to Tuluksak, but just enough to top them off. They were told those barges were delivering fuel to other villages, too, so they didn't bring them their full order. By the end of September, they'd only received 12,000 gallons of their 38,000-gallon fuel purchase. The village had been asking where their fuel was and why it was delayed.
They said something about their parts being missed, or one part that they ordered came in and it was the wrong one. And then they're saying the water was too low, and they actually came in with the water very low.
The water drops as it gets colder, making it harder for the barges to navigate the river. While they were waiting this September, the village ran low on fuel.
There was just like a couple of nights that they had to keep the lights off because of no fuel or low fuel. And then to make it worse, the corporation ran out of fuel too.
With the village's two main fuel sources running on empty, they borrowed from the school before deciding to make an emergency fuel order from Top Fuel in Bethel. The barge came shortly after. Now, the village has its fuel, and they're confident they have enough to make it till next spring, when they expect their next delivery. In Nepasquiak and Nunupachuk, they're hoping the barges make it out before the river starts to freeze. Wagner says they've still gone out on deliveries when the barges are breaking through a couple inches of ice. After that, they'll be out delivering again in the spring, as soon as the ice goes out. In Bethel, I'm Sunny Bean.
An international human rights commission has found that mining practices in British Columbia could violate the fundamental human rights of communities and tribes in southeast Alaska. As KSTK's Sage Smiley reports, it's a significant step in a years-long effort by southeast tribal leaders to have a say in the permitting of Canadian mine projects.
Wrangell Island sits tucked at the mouth of the Stikine River Delta. The silty water has sustained migratory birds, salmon, and people for thousands of years.
If I don't have enough salmon on a weekly basis, I feel like I am going to shrivel up and die.
Utsin Esther Reese is the tribal administrator for Wrangell's tribal government.
But in all seriousness, my ancestors have managed the waterways and the lands in this area since time immemorial. They found the oldest domesticated dog bone on the back channel, and it is 10,000 years old. And so it just shows how long our people have been on these lands and have relied on the waterways for our very survival.
Reese is also president of the Southeast Alaska Indigenous Transboundary Commission, a nonprofit consortium of 15 tribes that advocates for watershed protections and tribal representation in environmental decision-making processes.
The fact that there are these mines above the colonial border that do not have the best interest at heart for the environment and for living gently on the land is basically what we're fighting against.
The largest tributary of the Stikine River, the Iskut, across the border in Canada, is almost entirely staked with mineral exploration claims. Southeast communities and tribal governments and Alaska's congressional delegation have long expressed concerns with mining practices in the Canadian province of British Columbia. Many operational and proposed mines in the province straddle what are called transboundary watersheds that flow from BC to southeast Alaska. Recent scientific studies have found that even if a mine doesn't have a catastrophic failure, mines can have watershed impacts hundreds of miles downstream and years into the future. In 2020, the Southeast Alaska Indigenous Transboundary Commission filed an international human rights complaint against the federal government of Canada and the provincial government of British Columbia. The complaint cites what's called the American Declaration of the Rights and Duties of Man, an international agreement formed in 1948 as one of the first actions of the United Nations. It's a non-binding declaration on the fundamental economic, social, and cultural rights of humans. Guy Archibald is the executive director of the Southeast Alaska Indigenous Transboundary Commission.
We filed a complaint alleging that Canada has violated that declaration because they have not consulted with anybody, and specifically the tribes here in Southeast Alaska, on any of these mining projects.
Canadian officials took almost a year to respond to the complaint, well outside the designated time for response, which led to some back and forth over the ensuing years. In late August, the International Commission, called the Inter-American Commission on Human Rights, agreed that Canadian mining practices could be violating the fundamental rights of Southeast tribes and communities. That kicked off another round of review and opportunities to comment. Archibald says he hopes the Inter-American Commission will decide in favor of Southeast tribes. In his view, it would fundamentally change the way the Canadian federal and BC provincial governments approach mining.
They would have to assure that these mines are not going to pollute our waters. They're going to have to consult with us. They're going to have to respect our traditional cultural opportunities, some of which now reside within Canada and within BC.
Canada wouldn't be forced to comply with recommendations from the International Human Rights Commission. It doesn't have any enforcement power, but Archibald says it could help.
Even if Canada kind of refuses to implement these recommendations, it would be a big embarrassment to them on the world stage that they do not uphold human rights. And I would also hope that any potential investor in any of these mining companies would also have second thoughts about investing their hard-earned money in the companies that violate human rights.
The Inter-American Commission on Human Rights did not respond to a request for comment on the evaluation process. In an emailed statement, a spokesperson for the Canadian Department of Justice said it is proactively participating and that, quote, Canada recognizes the legitimacy of the petition process. Reese, Wrangell's tribal administrator, says a finding in favor of Southeast tribes would be a historic recognition of traditional territories and the rights of Indigenous people to be able to protect them.
It's a very important fight. It's an emotional fight. We are not just fighting for us, we're fighting for those who come after us, just like those who came before us.
Southeast tribes and the Canadian government have 4 months to respond to the initial finding by the Inter-American Human Rights Commission. The commission could then issue a final finding early next year. In Wrangell, I'm Sage Smiley.
Ketchikan's tribe wants to change the community's designation under the federal subsistence rules to give residents more access to subsistence resources. The tribe is asking to change from urban to rural status, which would apply to all 14,000 residents in the Ketchikan Gateway Borough. As Coast Alaska's Angela Denning reports, the tribe hopes that recent changes to the designation process will help it win approval.
Most communities in Alaska are designated by the federal government as rural, recognizing a lifestyle that is inextricably tied to the land. But there are urban exceptions, like Anchorage, Juneau, and Ketchikan. It's a status that's overseen by the Federal Subsistence Board. The urban communities don't have a subsistence priority like the rest of the state. That means they have limited access to subsistence resources on federal lands. Tony Gallegos is with the Ketchikan Indian community.
It's an unfairness to the system because we're urban. We're not considered to have access to those resources.
For example, Ketchikan residents, including tribal members, can't fish for ouligan in the Unik River, while residents from smaller nearby communities can, even though their ancestors have been harvesting the little smelt species for thousands of years. Gallegos has been working on a proposal to change the community's status from urban to rural through the Federal Subsistence Board.
The tribe wants to remove impediments from their access to traditional foods that they depend upon, and by being in a community that's considered urban, nobody in the community has the designation of federally recognized subsistence user.
The rural, non-rural status goes back to 1980, when the Alaska National Interest Lands Conservation Act, or ANILCA, was put into law. It designated more than 100 million acres of federal land in Alaska into parks, recreation areas, and refuges. And it was then that communities were labeled rural or urban.
It's a big deal to rescind these things.
Brent Vickers is an anthropologist with the Federal Office of Subsistence Management. His office will make a recommendation on the proposal next fall. He says the process to change a community's status now takes at least 4 years, much longer than it used to. That's because public input is a major part of the process. Until 2015, it was decided mostly by numbers, things like the average household income and the number of hotels and grocery stores in a community.
It really didn't have opportunities for much input and was really just based on these kind of quantitative metrics.
The process changed in 2015 after complaints and a review to a more comprehensive approach. Now, Vickers says, the board considers more factors and relies heavily on the recommendations of the subsistence regional advisory councils.
Now, the analysis will look at all sorts of things, basically painting a picture of what these communities are like, what it's like to live in these communities.
In Ketchikan's case, there are about 14,000 people in the borough, but it's also isolated on an island off the road system. The community has a large indigenous population. But the rural status wouldn't just affect tribal members. It would qualify all Ketchikan borough residents as subsistence users, no matter their background. Wildlife officials also would be required to prioritize their needs over commercial and sport users. Gallegos says it's the third time the Ketchikan tribe has sought a change, but he hopes for a different result this time. He says both Ketchikan City and Borough have passed resolutions in support of a rural status.
Right now, the tribe is trying to work within the system as it's structured with the rules and regulations that are in place, trying to see if we can go ahead and break down this barrier.
Since the designation process changed in 2015, the Federal Subsistence Board has only considered one proposal in Alaska. That was for the community of Moose Pass near Seward on the Kenai Peninsula. It had been considered part of the urban Seward area, but gained rural status in 2021. Reporting for Coast Alaska in Petersburg, I'm Angela Denning.
Today's KMXT Local News is brought to you in part by Discover Kodiak, a one-stop source for visitor information on Kodiak and other destinations around the state. On the web at kodiak.org and at the Visitor Center in the Ferry Terminal Building at 100 Marine Way, 486-4782.
The U.S. targets Hamas's pocketbook. I'm Novosavo with a Marketplace Minute. The Treasury Department is sanctioning 10 people and organizations in Gaza, Turkey, Sudan, Algeria, and Qatar. They allegedly provided financing for the militant group which massacred more than 1,000 Israelis on October 7. Some of those sanctioned are said to manage Hamas's investment portfolio. United Airlines is planning to experiment with a new boarding process that's slightly quicker. It will allow some passengers with window seats to board first, followed by middle and aisle seats. Families and group reservations will still board together. Higher prices lifted consumer goods giant Procter & Gamble's quarterly profits to $4.5 billion. Its sales volume declined. I'm Novosavo with a Marketplace Minute.
Marketplace Minute is supported by KeyBank. Learn more at key.com/cybersecurity.
This is the Island Messenger, a look at personal messages, the weather, and community announcements.
Good afternoon and welcome to your Island Messenger for Wednesday. It is the 18th day of October, the year 2023. The sun rose today at 8:51. It will set again at 6:57. That will give us 10 hours and 6 minutes of daylight, a loss of 4 minutes and 52 seconds. Our record high temperature for this date was 55 degrees, set in 1978, and our record low was 23 degrees, set in 2016. Currently 49 degrees, it is fair and windy. West winds steady at 26 at the airport right now, gusting to 47. And they do have 10 miles of visibility. Sunny skies for the rest of the day with a high near 48. Northwest winds around 30. Mostly clear overnight tonight with a low around 38. West winds to 25, and mostly sunny for Thursday with a high near 50. Northwest winds continuing, but coming down to 15 or 20. And even though they're saying mostly cloudy skies for Friday, they are calling for mostly sunny skies for Saturday and Sunday and Monday, partly sunny skies on Tuesday. Looking at our local tides, we have a high tide coming up. That will happen at 4:20 this afternoon here on the east side. It'll be 9.6 feet, followed by a low tide at 11:11 of minus 2/10. Over on the west side, your high tide will happen at 4:50 p.m. and be 14.7 feet in Larsen Bay, followed by a low tide at 11:34 p.m. of minus 7/10. Looking at our marine weather, Mariners, here is your forecast for Marmot Island to Sitkanat, Kodiak's east side, out to 15 nautical miles. Small craft advisory through Thursday, northwest 30 for today and tonight. 9-foot seas, coming down to 8 feet tonight. For tomorrow, west 25, coming down to 15 in the afternoon with seas to 6 feet, diminishing to 4 feet tomorrow night. For the Shelikof Strait on our west side, gale warning for today, west winds to 40 knots, gusting to 50 out of bays and passes with 10-foot seas. For tonight, west wind to 25 knots, gusting to 35 out of bays and passes with 8-foot seas. And for tomorrow, west winds to 20 knots in the Shelikof, 5-foot seas. For Thursday night, look for north winds to 15, seas coming down to 3 feet. I have just been handed a notice that the big pumpkin patch and sale put on by the Kodiak 4-H will be going on this Saturday, October 21st, at the fairgrounds. It'll be from 12 to 2 p.m. or until the pumpkins are sold out. There will be a pumpkin patch, bake sale, and an opportunity to take fall photos. Free admission, cash or check for the pumpkins, all of their activities by donation. And that's sponsored by 4-H Matson and the Kodiak Rodeo and State Fairground. Again, that starts Saturday, 12 p.m. at the fairgrounds. Meetings going on do not include the meeting of the Planning and Zoning Commission, which was to happen today. That's been canceled. However, the Kodiak Island Borough Assembly will be having its regular meeting tomorrow in the Borough Assembly Chambers at 6:30 p.m. And on October 24th, the Parks and Recreation Committee's regular meeting will be happening in the Borough Conference Room at 11 a.m. I believe that's Tuesday. All these meetings are open to the public. Kodiak Elders Coffee Tea Hour is happening on Friday. That goes on from 10:30 a.m. to 12:30 p.m. over at the Koniag Conference Area on Near Island at 194 Alamac Drive. Kodiak elders of all stripes are invited to join them for coffee, tea, and refreshments, and another drawing workshop with Janet Bain. Supplies and refreshments are provided, and transportation is available for beneficiaries. For more information or to arrange a ride, contact Elder Services at 907-486-7352. But again, that's Friday, starting at 10:30 a.m. over in the Koniag Conference Area on Near Island. Well, fun drama and thrills coming up. The Lion, the Witch, and the Wardrobe by C.S. Lewis will be presented by the Kodiak High School Shakespeares this weekend. Four public performances only, Friday at 7 p.m., Saturday at 2 p.m. and 7 p.m., and Sunday at 2 p.m. Tickets are available at kodiakshakespeares.luduse.com or at the door. Bring the family and come watch the fantasy classic live at the Gerald C. Wilson Auditorium. Again, that's Friday at 7, Saturday 2 and 7, and Sunday at 2. The Kodiak Fire Department would like to remind you that cooking safety starts with you. Here are some safety tips. Watch what you heat. Keep a close eye on what you're cooking. If a small grease fire does start in your kitchen, put a lid over the pan and turn off the burner. Don't douse it with water. And have a kid and pet free zone at least 3 feet around the stove to prevent any potential accidents. The fun part is the regional Kodiak Fire Departments are hosting an open house at the United States Coast Guard Firehouse. That's happening this Saturday from 10 a.m. to 2 p.m. Lots of fun for the kids, including bounce houses, food, a fire truck display, meet and greet with Sparky, and learning activities and games. So lots of fun this Saturday, 10 a.m. to 2 p.m., over at the United States Coast Guard Fire and Rescue House, presented by all of our fire departments. Senior citizens in Kodiak is in need of paper bags. Make sure they are not torn or soiled, and they can be dropped off at the Senior Center between 8:30 a.m. and 4:30 p.m. Monday through Friday. Canna Elder Services has been presenting Elders Afternoon Game Time. The next one will happen October 25th, which I believe is Wednesday, October 25th, from 2:30 p.m. to 4:30 p.m. at the Kodiak Public Library. And it features food, fun, and friends. Transportation is available for beneficiaries. Call 907-486-7352 to schedule a ride, or for more information, But otherwise, it is next Wednesday, 2:30 to 4:30 at the Kodiak Public Library. Lots of fun for elders. The Alaska Department of Fish and Game announces the Kodiak Regional Planning Team will meet Tuesday, November 9th at 9 a.m. by Zoom. Topics of the meeting will be an overview of the 2023 releases and egg takes and returns for Katoy Bay and Pillar Creek hatcheries, summaries of the 2023 salmon harvest, and the AD-FNG and KRAA data collection and research projects, as well as a discussion of designing criteria for unique and wild stocks in the Kodiak area. The meeting is open to the public, attendance, and participation. For additional information, including a Zoom link, contact Takoda, T-A-K-O-D-A, .Edlund, E-D-L-U-N-D, at alaska.gov. That's Takoda, T-A-K-O-D-A, .Edlund, E-D-L-U-N-D, at alaska.gov.
Listen for the Island Messenger here on Public Radio KMXT three times a day, Monday through Friday at 9 a.m., during the Midday Report at 12:20, and in the evening at 7 o'clock. If you have a community announcement or personal message, including lost and found items or pets, you can call KMXT at 486-3181, fax us at 486-2733, or email psa@kmxt.org.